And now, a man who campaigned against Barack Obama in all 57 states, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. My name is Mark Gillar. My special guest today is Joseph Farah, the founder and publisher of WorldNet Daily. He's also the author of the Tea Party Manifesto. Joseph, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark. Great to be with you.
I read the book last night. I have to tell you, it's a very compelling read. It's hard to put it down. You're very concise and to the point, so you can finish it in one sitting. And there is no fat in this book. It is all meat. And I have to tell you, it was a very enjoyable read.
Well, thank you, Mark. You know, my idea in writing this book was to really offer something of a love letter to the Tea Party movement because, as you know, I'm a big fan. I've been a fan even before there was a Tea Party movement. I was fanning the flames for it many years ago, and you know it offers two things: encouragement, and also just some advice that I think is really that Tea Party activists across this country need to hear. And I know some of it's a little bit controversial, and I think there's, you know, plenty of room for controversy and debate within the Tea Party movement about the direction of the movement should go in, and that's what I'm trying to get started, because one of the things that I have seen, as you probably know from reading the book, I'm a little bit concerned about people putting constraints on the Tea Party movement. I don't think this is a movement that needs constraints. I think it's a movement that we need to pour gasoline on.
Well, by constraints, I agree. By constraints, you mean an over-focusing on economic issues?
Absolutely. I think that's the biggest danger. And, of course, we have, you know, groups like the National Federation and groups like FreedomWorks, and they have, you know, literally mapped out the agenda, and it's all economic. And I look at that and I say to myself, I don't think that America's biggest problems, its root problems, are economic. I know the economy is very much on all of our minds. It's certainly on mine. And make no mistake, when I say this, you know, you're talking to somebody who believes the budget should be radically cut, that we should, you know, do our best to eradicate the deficit and the debt and cut taxes. I mean, I take a backseat to no one on recognizing how important those economic issues are. But I see the economy, the economic problems we have in this country more as a result of other issues. And when I say that, for instance, let's just take one example. Let's take the example of illegal immigration. I have seen, you know, Tea Party leaders suggest that this is not an issue that is a Tea Party issue because it's not economic in nature. And I would say to that, that's crazy, because the economic implications of illegal immigration cannot be overstated. They simply cannot be overstated. And that's true of many, many other issues that are not on the contract from America. And so, you know, while I appreciate the fact that anybody wants to get out there and say, you know, this is what I think the Tea Party movement is about, should be about, I just want to see broader debate on that. And I don't want to see Tea Party activists and Tea Party groups around the country kind of fall into lockstep behind this notion that it's all about materialism. It's all about the economy. I think that's a mistake. To me, it's, you know, if you want to find one thing that it's about, it should be about liberty. It should be about the rule of law and the will of the people. I think, you know, if you want to circle the wagons and really get right down to what it's all about, that's a nicer umbrella to put it all under than economic concerns.
Let me throw out a suggestion about why the Tea Party might be avoiding the Arizona immigration law. As you know, the favorite weapon by the left against the Tea Party is the false accusation of racism. And given the fact that anyone who supports the Arizona immigration law is labeled a racist, is it possible that the Tea Party is avoiding the issue altogether because there have already been enough charges of racism against the Tea Party?
Well, this movement, this idea of economy only really started before the NAACP ever raised that issue. And I got to tell you that I think it was a strategic mistake for the NAACP to do that. And I think they honestly, at the end of the day, probably regret ever doing it because, of course, there was no evidence to support it whatsoever. And whether or not, you know, Tea Party activists and have taken strong stands on illegal immigration, and of course they have, it wouldn't make any difference because 73% of the American people are behind what Arizona did by the most recent polls I've seen, and it's a righteous decision. And when you're involved in political activism, you know, you have to do the right thing. Ultimately, that's what it comes down to. And, you know, obviously you want to explain why it's the right thing and as appropriate language as possible. I just think the Tea Party movement has done that. And, you know, I don't want to just – I'm providing the illegal immigration example as one example. There are really a thousand of them. And, you know, I've had the opportunity to meet hundreds of Tea Party activists around the country at rallies and conferences and so forth. And I think that this is the most potent and exciting and dynamic grassroots political movement in our history. And I don't want to see it fall into the trap that the Republican Party did, because that's why we need a Tea Party movement. You know, it's the Republican Party that has been very, very weak, for instance, on illegal immigration. It has allowed us to not really have an alternative to, you know, policing our borders and those kinds of things. The Republican Party was promoting, even under President Bush, the idea of, you know, well, this is just, you know, we need comprehensive immigration reform, and, you know, we're going to have to figure out a way to overlook the fact that we've got 30 million Americans who don't belong here and those kinds of things. I just don't want to see the Tea Party movement become kind of a mirror of the Republican Party, because what's so exciting about the Tea Party movement is they've given us voice for the concerns that the Republican Party has been ignoring.
The immigration law in many people's minds, or the immigration reform that the left is pushing for right now, in many people's minds is about nothing other than bringing in more voters who will support the Democratic Party. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's partly true. I think that's a big motivation for many Democrats, but it's not the only one. Unfortunately, it's not the only one. And I think the other big factor here is that we have a very significant percentage of Democrats and Democratic Party leaders who really, at the end of the day, have no respect for American sovereignty whatsoever. And I think that, and, you know, I can give you dozens of examples of that, but I think that it's that fact, in addition to the, you know, finding new voters, that motivates this stand. I think there are a lot of them that would just really just as soon erase borders altogether, not have America, you know, as a self-governing nation, but would be happy to have one big happy world where we really, leaders don't really have accountability to the people, and where the rule of law as we know it, with the Constitution as the basis, would no longer be in effect. And that's a much bigger problem than just a bunch of guys who want to get more constituents to vote for them.
That is a bigger problem. And, you know, it's interesting how many times the term global governance comes up when you're listening to an environmentalist talk about global warming. It seems like that's at least one of the tactics, one of the avenues that they're taking to try to bring about this global governance.
That's right.
Talk
that's
to me a little
bit
about
excuses. One of the excuses is global warming. It's a fantasy problem, unlike illegal immigration, which is a very real, documentable, measurable problem. Global warming is not. It's make believe science, and I think that's the major reason that it's out there and being promoted by Al Gore and Barack Obama and most of the Democratic Party and many Republican politicians as well, promoting this idea because there is if it were real, America alone couldn't tackle the problem. And so let's find the global mechanisms that can take care of this problem. And of course, what it's really all about is about redistributing wealth around the planet. That's the only way that it fundamentally could be addressed if it were a real crisis.
It seems like there are so many questions that the media could be asking about global warming that they do not ask. For instance, they always like to talk about the $30 million that Enron, I think, not Enron, but ExxonMobil invested in global warming research, but they never want to follow the money on the other side. They don't want to look at how much money Goldman Sachs is going to make, how much money General Electric is going to make, how much money Al Gore is going to make. But for me, if you wanted to demonstrate to anyone why CO2 is not a problem, I think there's a site called ilovecO2.com, and you can take a look at two seeds planted at the same time. On one side, they keep the CO2 level at a parts per million of about 400, which is just a little higher than our atmosphere. And then in the other contained area, they have the CO2 level at about 1,260 parts per million. And the benefit on the plants is amazing. I mean, the plant in the higher CO2 environment has more leaves, you know, grows faster, taller, is healthier. And when I've shown people that before, it's like, how can you label this a pollutant, if it's so good for plants? This is like aerial plant food, and I've yet to have a liberal environmentalist give me an answer for that. Not
one. That's because there is no answer, and it's amazing because these are the same people who will tell you, you know, how we have to have reverence for the trees. And the trees breathe, you know, carbon dioxide. And so it's completely, you know, it doesn't make any sense. If you try to look at it rationally and have a reasonable debate about it, of course, there is no answer to that. There is no really scientific basis for coming up with the idea that man-produced CO2 is really a significant problem of any kind. I mean, it's what we produce is infinitesimally small. It's minuscule compared to what, you know, nature does, and so you know it's a phantom problem. It's a fraud and a hoax. And the great thing is that I think Americans have come to that conclusion despite a barrage of propaganda to the contrary. You know, they've made the conclusions about this, and you don't hear nearly as much about global warming these days as we used to.
No, and it's amazing that Al Gore, who's been the world's biggest cheerleader for it, has kind of been shut down by some personal problems, and that seems to be hurting the movement a great deal for them. It's interesting to me how much of that movement tends to hinge on the activities of one individual. This guy is not a scientist. He doesn't know the first thing about science. If you look at his graph in An Inconvenient Truth, he actually got the underlying premise backwards. Increased heat causes the ocean to release CO2, so CO2 follows heat. Heat doesn't follow CO2. The guy's just an absolute joke, but frankly, I'm kind of glad to see him be distracted by other issues at this time.
Besides that, he's also a very self-interested party, and nobody talks about that. And the people who are promoting this notion, Most of the folks who we know publicly are self-interested. They will stand to make a fortune if these cap and trade ideas actually are made policy.
Well, a lot of people have predicted that Al Gore will be the world's first green billionaire if cap and trade policy becomes law, and I think that's true. And again, perhaps between his divorce and I think what he's been
going to need it.
In one, yeah, yeah. And of course, another thing that I thought was humorous about all this is essentially, you know, Al Gore has been accused of exposing himself to female massage therapists, and the police have decided not to pursue it due to a lack of evidence. So
it's pretty embarrassing.
Yeah, I think that's got to be hurt from a machismo standpoint. Well, I'll tell you what, I've gotten you off track a little bit with global warming. I want to dive further into your book. In Chapter 2 of the book, you do a great job of correcting some myths about various forms of government. You talk about the fact that anarchism is really on the right, fascism is really on the left. And why don't you take my listeners through a little government lesson right now,
yeah,
as you did in Chapter 2.
It's a very important concept, because of where it puts us on the political spectrum. And I think it's really indisputable when you think about it. I think that the political spectrum is defined by where people place government authority. And now a lot of folks tend to, in conventional thinking, place anarchism and communism both to the far left. That's the biggest mistake, I think, that we make. And it's easy to make because you'll often find communists and anarchists at the same demonstrations and rallies and protests.
Right.
You know, you've got a collection of anarchists and communists together protesting various things. But that's not what defines the political spectrum. Here's how I look at it. I look at the extreme right of the political spectrum as the one where people who would have no use for government whatsoever. They would be people who don't want to have government at all. That, of course, those would be the anarchists. They would be, on my political spectrum, the extreme right. And then next to them would be the people who acknowledge that, you know, well, government has a role, but we really, really want to restrict it immensely, and those would be, you know, libertarians. And then as you move over to the left, I think you would have people like conservatives. You know, that's the word we use to describe them. It's not one of my favorite words. But if you think of the conservative movement, they'd be a little bit to the left of libertarians. And they would think, for instance, what would differentiate them from libertarians is, you know, libertarians say, well, you know, we want to have a borderless country. You know, we should have there's no reason to have maintained borders. People ought to just be able to freely move around. And conservatives would tend to say, no, borders serve a very important function. And so those would be the conservatives. And, you know, I would also, in addition to, you know, using today's conservatives as an example of, you know, the center of that political spectrum, I would say that our founding fathers were in the center of the political spectrum. They did not like government. They did something radical and revolutionary in their time. They were the first people, really, in world history to say we're going to take the shackles off the people and put them on government. And so I put them, along with, you know, most conservatives today, in the center of the political spectrum. So you move over to the left, and who do you have? Well, you have people who are starting to believe in socialism in one form or another. And, you know, you might have the democratic socialists next to them. These are people who say, well, you know, I think there's a proper role for government to get involved in the, you know, production of goods and services, and maybe public ownership of some industry and whatnot. And then you keep moving over, and so you start getting to the more totalitarian nature of the left. And by the way, the folks I put over there on the absolute extreme would be the communists. These would be the hardcore, totalitarian-minded communists that we have known through the decades, you know, and just to their right, but practically I call them kissing cousins, would be national socialists. That would be fascists. And that's another mistake I think that people make on the political spectrum, is they often put fascism and Nazism on the right, where it absolutely doesn't belong, because they are socialists.
Well, I appreciate that. I have to admit that it corrected some mistakes that I had believed in, and it was an important part of this book to separate that out. Now, one of the other things you talk about in the book that I feel is very important, and I'm not hearing a lot of people talk about, quite frankly, is that the state sovereignty movement is occurring simultaneously with the Tea Party movement.
Yes.
Why do you think that there hasn't been more said about that?
Yeah, it's really exciting stuff to see states asserting their legitimate constitutional authority, because we need that. Quite honestly, I mean, it's one of the unique things about the American system of government. It was founded with the idea that the Constitution limited the powers of the central or federal government to enumerated powers. And anything that wasn't enumerated was left to the several states. And there's a lot left. There's a lot of powers left over to the states. And as we've seen over the last certainly 40, 50 years, but you can go back further than that and go right back to the war between the states, really, to see Washington asserting more and more authority, and oftentimes in ways that are, you know, wholly in contrast with what the founders had in mind and what is specifically stated in the Constitution. And so what's happened, I think, very recently is that push has come to shove for a lot of states. They're going bankrupt. They're being asked, well, not asked, they're being forced to do more and more in terms of mandates that the Washington comes up with, mandates that they had no maybe desire to do themselves, and of course they have to come up with the money to do it, and so you've got states going broke all across this country. In addition to that, well, you know, a good example is what's happened with Obamacare, where you know, the federal government has come up with this notion that for the first time in American history, American people have to buy something. They are being told, but a gun is being put to their head, you have to buy this service. You have to buy health insurance. And we've got several states led by my own state of Virginia saying, no, where do you see any constitutional justification for that? And standing up for Virginia citizens trying at once to get the whole program overthrown, but at the very least to make sure that their citizens are exempt from that kind of tyranny. And you know, I agree with you. It's not much of a story. You have to look for these things happening in order to get an appreciation for it, which we do, as you know, at WorldNet Daily. And it's kind of a running story, the states asserting themselves, and it's a healthy thing. Honestly, I feel like it's you know, a God thing that this is happening at the same time that individuals are also asserting themselves through the Tea Party movement.
With regard to the health care bill, don't forget this falls within the federal government's right to tax.
Right, but it wasn't a tax.
Well, yeah, it was a non-tax that was such a non-tax that they're doubling the number of IRS agents to collect the non-tax.
Right, but when it, yeah, when it's convenient for them to sell it as a non-tax, they do. And when it's convenient for them to sell it as a tax, they do. They're the best of both worlds.
And that just shows that a major whopper on the part of the Obama administration has gone uncalled. And I want to get into the mainstream media's bias in a minute. But regarding the mainstream media's lack of calling Obama out on things, I would like you to hear a short clip of Barack Obama speaking to the SEIU in Ohio about the stimulus package.
An unprecedented Recovery Act. And we did it without the usual Washington earmarks and pork barrel spending. And Ohio, it is working.
Isn't that amazing that we passed a Recovery Act without any pork barrel spending?
Yeah, I mean, how many lives can you count in that clip? I mean, that is working, number one, that there weren't any pork barrel projects. I mean, it's the most loaded sentence I think I may have ever listened to in my life.
You have to dig around YouTube to find that. You know, in fact, I put that on YouTube. I have a little group I call the Common Sense Alliance, and I found that and put it out there. And I can only imagine that if George W. Bush had said the Iraq War isn't going to cost us a dime, mm-hmm. the mainstream media would have been all over that. But here's a guy that is talking about a stimulus bill that was essentially all pork. And he claims there was no pork in it, and not one major mainstream media organization called him out over that.
It's unbelievable. They live in a fantasy world in Washington, D.C., and sadly, for us, the what I call the establishment press is right there with them, living in that fantasy world, and they can't even see what you and I see on a clip like that. They can't hear it. They don't hear it the same way we do. It's like almost a learning disability prevents them to, because their worldview is one that suggests government is good. Government solves problems. Government is our God. Government is our savior. When you see a problem, the only way to address the problem is through some sort of government action or program.
I want to talk to you about Chapter 7 of your book, because I think you have set a goal for the Tea Party movement that is a very challenging goal, but one that might very well be obtainable, and I want to discuss it with you in detail, and that is that the Tea Party movement should try to take over both parties by 2014.
Yes, and I've been asked this question very few times. That means you really got through it, because it's kind of buried there in the back, isn't it? But the question often comes up.
Call me crazy, Joseph. I actually like to read the books of my guests before I have them on.
Well, especially early on in the Tea Party movement, and we are early on now. I mean, this movement's not even 2 years old, I don't think. Especially a year or so ago, I would get a lot of questions from media people. The big question was, what's the Tea Party movement going to do? Is it going to align itself with the Republican Party? Is it going to go third party? And those were seemingly the two choices that were put out there. And it was at that time, as this question kept coming up, that I, developed this idea. Both of those notions are too small, too short-sighted for a movement this big that represents more than half the American people, according to the polls. They show that more than half the country identifies with the Tea Party movement. And so I said, why should it be limited to redeeming one party or creating a third party? I see, and I really mean this, I believe that the Tea Party movement is broad enough and passionate enough that it can be a redemptive influence on both parties. Why should we only have one political party in America that still reveres the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence? That's what we have. Well, I'm not even sure we have one right now. But, would we be satisfied?
Rahm Emanuel says the Constitution's overrated. So,
yeah, and you've got what's his name, Representative Hare, who says, it doesn't matter what the Constitution says. I don't care what the Constitution says, and that's representative of a lot of opinion in Washington. But at the end of the day, wouldn't it be great? You know, it wasn't that long ago. I mean, it was certainly in my lifetime that we had two parties that were actually American parties, patriotic parties. Now, you could disagree with, you know, one or both on any number of issues, how you deal with national security threats or whatever. But let's think back to the JFK era. John F. Kennedy was president. John F. Kennedy was a patriotic American who understood that cutting taxes raises revenue for the federal government. It wasn't Ronald Reagan who made that discovery. He just rediscovered it. He even quoted Kennedy. And so, you know, Kennedy was somebody who, not to say he didn't have faults, but the party of JFK was an American party. And I think that, you know, that was 50 years ago. Why shouldn't we have the expectation of having two parties that legitimately are pro-American, pro-Constitution, pro-Declaration of Independence, people who are unashamed to stand up and sing the Star Spangled Banner and, you know, wave the American flag? That's what I want to see, and I believe the Tea Party movement is potent enough to deliver that over the long haul.
What do you make of the left's interpretation of the Tea Party? Because early on, the talking point was it's not grassroots, it's AstroTurf. And then they tried racism for a while. It didn't quite work. It seemed like they dropped it. And now they've come back and enlisted the help of the NAACP and the New Black Panther Party and some others. And they're on the racism kick again. But what do you think the left really makes of the Tea Party movement?
Well, it's fear. It's panicked. Because, you know, this is their worst nightmare, that ordinary, hardworking, productive Americans who have never before gone out and held a protest sign or marched in a rally would actually be out there in the streets in unprecedented numbers. They never dreamed this would happen. They thought they could just keep pushing and pushing and pushing till they got their way and enslaved the entire country, and what you're getting is pushback. And, you know, I'm not at all surprised by the fact that they fear this, they're vilifying it, they're panicked over it, and they recognize that we're on the precipice of a major electoral revolution in November, and so they resort to name-calling and what else they got in that arsenal of theirs.
I shouldn't admit this, but one of the things I like to do is put myself on the mailing list of people I don't agree with. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that in one of Nancy Pelosi's emails to her fan base, she stated that the Tea Party energy is real and then used that as an excuse to beg for money. From her followers. But you know, we've gone from Nancy Pelosi stating it was an AstroTurf movement to using the Tea Party in fundraising letters and actually admitting that it is a real movement and that the energy is real. And I think Barbara Boxer made a similar statement where she was saying, you know, she needed her people to match the energy of the Tea Party. So regardless of the racism charges and some of the things that they're stating publicly, when they're communicating privately to their groups, or at least they think they are, they seem to acknowledge that it's a formidable opponent.
And to just think, if Nancy Pelosi recognizes it, she lives and serves one of the most stacked districts in the entire country where it is practically inconceivable that she would not be reelected. And mm-hmm. even she feels it there. And, of course, she also feels it because she's a House Speaker. But, you know, she's not insulated from it, and that means it's touching every district, every congressional district in the country. And, you know, that's the beautiful thing. They can't deny it. Anybody who's held a town hall meeting from Washington recognizes these people are real. Nobody's paying them to do this. This isn't the result of some billionaire subsidizing a protest movement. That's what most of the protests on the left are about. I mean, there's usually some huge money behind them. There's nothing here. Mm-hmm. This is just ordinary people getting up, just getting to the point where they've had enough. They don't like the direction of their country, and it clicked all at once.
Well, it's interesting that the left likes to go through a couple of million signs at the Tea Parties and finds one or two that has a misspelled word in it, and then tries to paint the Tea Party movement as being really stupid. But to your point, when you've got a bunch of people who are genuine grassroots activists and they make their own signs, you know, they go down to Hobby Lobby and buy some poster board and a black felt marker, and they make their own signs, you're going to have an occasional misspelled word. In fact, you would think after what happened with, was it Coakley who misspelled Massachusetts? I don't remember.
I'd love to see members of Congress make their own signs and have a spelling contest over there.
One of the things I've noticed is that
it's a very entertaining thing to do is to go to a big Tea Party rally and just look at the signs. And they're almost universally uplifting. There's a strong spiritual component to them. There's patriotism, you know, oozing patriotism. We did a book called Don't Tread on Us, which is just a picture book. We looked at literally thousands and thousands of signs at the big 9/12 rally here in Washington, and we made a book out of it. And you know what? After looking at thousands and thousands and thousands of those signs, we never saw any racist signs. We saw a few misspellings. I would certainly think so, because there are no editors for protest signs. But we were so impressed with the content of those signs that we turned it into a beautiful picture book in full color and got Chuck Norris to do an introduction for it. And it's a very moving and inspirational product.
I've had a chance to glance at that, and I would agree with you, and I plan to get a copy of it. It's wonderful to see so many people that still believe in some of the same values of our founding fathers. And I would argue that the reason we don't see misspelled signs, like you said, on the part of the left, is that it's such an organized protest being backed by big money. It's like, here's your protest T-shirt. You know, here's a coupon to get a hamburger when it's over. Here's the protest bus. Get on the protest bus. Get off. Carry the protest sign. You know, recruit a bunch of SEIU people, a bunch of Acorn people. In fact, that clip we listened to from Barack Obama saying the stimulus package was pork-free was in front of an SEIU audience, and those were some of the prettiest, you know, well-designed signs, everybody actually holding the exact same sign. And when you have a legitimate grassroots movement, you're going to have some misspelled signs. And I think, if anything, that lends legitimacy to the grassroots nature of the Tea Party movement if we have a couple of misspelled signs every once in a while. And I agree with you. I'd love to see Congress, given all the stupid remarks that they make, I'd like to see them. You know, we even have a president who can't pronounce the word Corman. So I would love to see these people make their own signs. Now, what's interesting is that, let me find the exact page in the book I have it marked here. We start talking about how we have to take back America. And one of the things that I think you very accurately point out, you write that we have much work to do in taking back America's political institutions, but we must never overlook the power of America's cultural institutions mm-hmm. in shaping opinion. And you mentioned the free press, institutions of learning, foundations, churches, and the entertainment media. Let's talk about the churches for a second. It seems like there's a real double standard in terms of the way churches are treated by the media and churches are treated by our government. Let's talk about the fact that supposedly Sarah Palin went to a crazy church, a nutty, wacky church where they discussed witchcraft and believed that dinosaurs roamed the earth at the same time as people. And at the same time, Barack Obama and his family attended Jeremiah's Black Liberation Theology Church, the Church of Anti-Whitey, if you will, and the media was okay with that.
I might also point out that Barack Obama is supportive of building a gigantic mosque at 9/11 at the 9/11 site with foreign money, from, and many of the sources we don't even know where it's coming from, but we do know that it's largely foreign money. And he's outspoken about, absolutely, we've got to build this mosque there, you know. And so, you talk about double standards. There definitely are. Jeremiah Wright's a great example. You talk about fringe. I mean, I think that we can safely say that Jeremiah Wright is on, you know, way over on the fringe meter. And Sarah Palin's church is probably right in mainstream of evangelical Christianity.
Absolutely.
And so there you are. It's all from, you know, it's all based on the perspective of who's looking at it, what glasses they're using to see these things. And this idea of, you know, worldview is very important. Worldview is shaped more by the culture than it is by government. Government is the tool they use to coerce you to behave a certain way. But our worldview in this country is largely, in any country, is largely shaped by cultural institutions, beginning with, I think, the schools being among the most important. Well, who runs the schools? Well, most of our schools are run by government, and the federal government has recently begun asserting itself into the equation, just in, you know, really in recent years, and nobody...
Well, taking over all federal college loans, I mean, taking over the loan process.
Sure. I mean, you know, today it's unimaginable for most colleges that they could even exist without, you know, federal money. There's only a few that do. And so, you know, so you have this combination of government coercion and the cultural institutions, which are dominated by people who worship government. Socialist. That's what a socialist is. It's somebody who worships government. That's my definition. And that's what dominates my industry, the news media. I've seen it ever since I was, you know, a youngster entering the profession. I used to cover Hollywood as a journalist, as a reporter, and so I'm very familiar with the way Hollywood works. And it's just, you know, a collective kind of schizophrenia that prevails there. Are there exceptions? Yeah, but they're just that, they're exceptions. Most people there, you know, they have a leftist, socialist worldview. Why? I don't know. A lot of them are rich, but they don't want anybody else to get rich, I guess.
I guess not. Well, now let's talk about Hollywood for a second, because that's a real pet peeve of mine, and someone you're very familiar with, Eric Rush, and I actually met on the internet due to the fact that we were both putting out some stuff suggesting that Hollywood should be boycotted. And when you take a look at just how anti-Republican, how anti-conservative, how anti-Sarah Palin, for example, all these Hollywood stars happen to be. I mean, you even had people like Madonna and Sandra Bernhard and that little girl off the Heroes show, I forget her name, they're out there dropping the F-bomb repeatedly against Sarah Palin and John McCain. It's amazing just how threatened Hollywood seems to be by conservatives. But the question I have for you is, I mean, this country is at least made up of 50% conservatives. Why, as a group, can we not get together and say to ourselves, those movie tickets we buy, allow them to have money, power, and fame, and they use those elements to build a pedestal from which they preach down to us their liberal ideology. I'm not going to contribute to that cause anymore. Before the Tea Party was ever formed, Joseph, I started a group called the Conservative Consumer Coalition. And I tried to get people to boycott Hollywood stars who were outspokenly opposed to conservative values. I tried to get them to boycott advertisers that supported extremely left-wing news media outlets. And, you know, I ended up getting maybe 1,000 people to join this group. But for the most part, conservatives enjoyed their creature comforts. They enjoyed going to the movies. They enjoyed going to the theater. And they didn't seem willing to make a point in this way. I mean, we've historically been horrible at boycotts, horrible at rallies, although we're obviously much better now. But why won't conservatives get together and take back the media through the one thing they understand, money?
Excellent question. It goes to I don't think I covered it in the Tea Party Manifesto, but I did cover it in a book called Taking America Back, written in 2003. And my basic answer to that question is that conservatives are not revolutionaries. Conservatives are not radicals. And it's one of my biggest pet peeves. And in fact, when you adopt a label like conservative, you're telling people what you are. You want to conserve what we have. And as I wrote in that book, you know, there comes a time where conserving the liberty that we have left is really not enough. And that's what the founders realized. You know, they had it pretty good. They the American colonies were pretty prosperous. Life was good. It was probably better than it was for the average person in England at the time. And they didn't decide to throw off the yoke of the crown because of, you know, taxation or economic reasons at all. It was really about freedom. And conservatives are really not freedom fighters. They want to conserve the liberty we have, but by nature the way they struggle is completely defensive. And in other words, I'm drawing a line in the sand, and I don't want you to come any further than that line. And then when, you know, the left steps over that line, we draw a new line in the sand, and we just are basically in retreat. That's what conservatives are, and that's what the conservative movement has been. And that's why I'm so excited about the Tea Party movement that doesn't have that history, that isn't defined yet, that hasn't been shackled mentally about things you can do and cannot do. And that's the great potential, I think, that we have at this moment in history. We have millions of people that have joined the freedom movement spontaneously in a very short period of time, and they need to rewrite the rules. And I laugh when at this year's Conservative Political Action Conference meeting in Washington, I heard one of the speakers talk about how, you know, this was a traditional conservative activist who said, you know, we need to help the Tea Party movement because we're their big brothers and we have a lot to teach them. And I laughed because it's really just the opposite. We have to unlearn the lessons that conservatives have taught themselves, because they've just really put themselves in a box that they it's almost impossible for them to escape. And they have what I call, and I'm, you know, Middle Eastern by heritage, and I was a Middle Eastern correspondent, and in Middle Eastern terms, it's called a dhimmi mentality. It's non-Muslims have this. In order to survive in their society, they have to act like second-class citizens. And in effect, that's what conservatives are in America today. With all the cultural institutions against them, they have that kind of a dhimmi mentality. Well, and of course, there are exceptions to this, but I think that's basically the problem.
Well, I think you've made the case that we need to take back America. You've made the case that we can take back America, and you've actually done a good job of outlining some of the steps that we need to take back America, which leads me to my next point. You are holding something called the Taking Back America Conference. What is it, September 17th? Tell us more about that.
Yeah, Taking America Back 2010. The website is takingamericaback2010.com. And really, I mean, we thought of this as really a Tea Party event, even though, you know, we're a corporation, we're not a Tea Party group, but we couldn't be more in sympathy with the Tea Party movement. And as you probably know, WorldNet Daily was the first news organization in the country to assign a full-time reporter to the Tea Party movement. I don't even know if there are any others yet today. And we've been there and have, you know, really provided immense coverage to this movement, and so Taking America Back Conference was really conceived with that in mind. We wanted to bring Tea Party activists to a national convention that had, I would say, a broader perspective than a conservative national conference would. And so we're having Michelle Bachmann and Alan Keyes and lots of fine speakers, but it's also going to be a very interactive, participatory kind of a convention. Debates, lots of engagement, lots of interactivity with people who, you know, are in attendance. It's their conference. It's not just to sit there passively and listen to speakers. And yeah, it's in Miami from September 16th through 18th. It's 3 days of hopefully inspiration and strategy for moving forward. And if you want to find out more about that, takingamericaback2010.com.
Fantastic. We'll post that address on our website. And finally, I'd like to just congratulate you. If I'm not mistaken, the last set of rankings that came out puts WorldNet Daily as what, the number two conservative site on the internet?
Well, you know, we've never considered ourselves a conservative site.
I shouldn't have used that word.
And I don't think Drudge has either, and he's number one.
right.
But we've always been 1 and 2. Drudge and WorldNet Daily have been 1 and 2, no matter what you label them, in terms of sites that conservatives and Tea Party activists and anybody who's got any inclination toward, you know, liberty, Drudge and WorldNet Daily have always been 1 and 2 from the day we started it. In fact, we started WorldNet Daily 2 years after Drudge was the internet, and the first thing I did before I launched was to call Drudge and tell him what I was doing and tell him, you know, we're not competing with you because we're going to do some things that are very, very different from you. And I even tried to hire Matt Drudge to work for us, and I think I almost got him back then. But the point was that what we do that really nobody else does, and I mean that, nobody else does, is the investigative reporting, independent, with a worldview that is, honestly, the best way I would describe it is that Judeo-Christian worldview, a Western civilization worldview. Does that mean we're biased? I guess so, and I think everybody is. And most of my colleagues are so biased in the other direction that attributes, I think that's why we've had some success.
I think that would have a lot to do with it. In fact, I think the other side is so far to the left, they don't even know where they are on the political spectrum.
that's right. Well, they sure don't want to be near those Nazis, which I think they're right next to on the.
That's a really funny point. One last thing I'll ask you. I don't want to put you.
I'll tell you, that's why they have to reject that political spectrum, no matter how much sense it makes. They don't want to be next to the Nazis.
That's funny. The last thing I want to ask is we had talked about the idea before about conservatives not being willing to get together and flex their consumer muscle. Do you think it would be a good idea for Tea Partiers to do that?
Say that again.
Oh, well, we had discussed earlier the idea that I had, and frankly it didn't come to full fruition, about having, I originally tried to get conservatives to flex their consumer muscle. Do you think it would be a good idea for Tea Partiers?
Most definitely, but here's the thing that you might disagree with. I'm not so sure it even has to be in an organized way. I think, one of the things I love about the Tea Party movement is that it's so decentralized. It's just a bunch of people taking action. They've discovered something, and they're going to do something about it. What I'd like to see happen is for Tea Party activists to also discover these cultural influences and how they are just as tyrannical as government is in a lot of ways, and they're setting the stage for the political tyranny that we're experiencing, and then use discernment individually about what they can do about that. You know, I'm not so sure that the boycotts are ever going to be as effective as just a collective and individual understanding that I say this in my previous book, Taking America Back, that, you know, we're supposed to be a self-governing nation. And what that means is that we govern ourselves. We don't, you know, we really don't need that much help from government to tell us what to do. We're supposed to be responsible people who can take care of ourselves, and government's there to clean up the occasional mess when somebody steps out of line. That's the kind of world the founders envisioned. And to do that, you need to be cognizant of what you do in your own life that contributes to problems or that contributes to good things happening. For instance, you know, I think it's so important for people to think about where they send their kids to school. If you don't want to live in a government-dominated society, I would say one of the first things you should do is take your child out of a government-dominated school and find an alternative, whether it's a religious school or whether it's homeschooling. There are much better alternatives. Not only is the government school system not doing a good job at educating kids, but it's turning them into, you know, little robots, basically, and malcontents in many cases. So that's the way I'd like to see it work. I'd like to people to discover these things for themselves, use discernment. So, like you said, why should I pay, you know, $12 or whatever it is to go see a movie that's going to insult everything I stand for? I can't understand why people do. You know, I used to have to see every movie. I used to be a movie person, a movie reporter. I was part of my job. It was so disgusting. I couldn't wait to get home and wash, take a shower after I'd see these things. And so, you know, I think that's the best way it's going to work. And I'm not sure we're ever going to build a big enough organization that can, you know, sort of do the work for us and tell us how to do that. I just hope it happens like the Tea Party movement has.
Yeah, that's probably going to be the best way for it to come about. And I think if you look at the decline of the traditional print media, for example, and all the newspapers in the country that financially just aren't making it right here. I'm broadcasting out of the Bryan-College Station area right next to Texas A&M, and you know, I know for a fact our local paper has had some layoffs, but it seems like Americans are just saying, let's cut off our subscriptions because these people don't stand for anything that we believe in. And what I can tell you is that, by the way, I sent my son to private school from kindergarten through 12th grade, and he's now at a public university and doing very well. And I would not have done it any other way. That is one of the first steps. But it would seem to me that if you take a look at what's happening out there, a lot of people have made that decision. You know, they will keep the paper while the kids are still in school, you know, so that they can clip out all the honor rolls and you know, the sporting events and so forth. But then once that's over with, there's really not a need for the local newspaper anymore. And I think they're either going to have to get with the program, or we're going to see a lot of the longtime newspapers start to fail financially.
That's right. And I knew this was happening. I could see it because I was inside the newspaper industry, and I saw what was happening before the internet came along. And I knew, having, you know, been able to run daily newspapers, I knew that there was a hunger for this kind of journalism. But there were also other problems that the newspaper industry was having. And when the internet came along, it just magnified the problems that the industry had. And of course, you see it imploding so fast that the industry doesn't even know how to deal with it. They're literally, that's all, they're preoccupied with this problem night and day. And I'd love to see the same kind of thing happen with the entertainment industry. I it may seem hard to imagine right now, but there's some good news on the horizon, and it's actually been around for quite a while. I discovered this back in the 80s when I was covering the entertainment industry, and this is just anecdotal, but, you know, R-rated movies at that time were primarily what was being produced by Hollywood, in spite of the fact that they were not the most popular movies. And it took Hollywood two decades, really, to figure this out, to say, wait a minute, you know, the average R-rated movie makes X number of dollars, but the average G-rated movie makes 10 times more. Why are we making so many R-rated movies and so few G-rated movies? It took them 20 years to figure that out,
wow,
even with me and others prodding them. And eventually they figured it out, and today, you know, they're making far more family-friendly. Not enough for me, but far more. And so, you know, they are responsive to the marketplace. It just takes a while for them to see straight.
I haven't been in a movie theater since, I think, Harry Potter 2, and I wish I'd have stopped earlier. I really do. I'm not embarrassed. I mean, I get asked all the time, what did you think about this movie? What did you think about that movie? And I just point blank say, you know what? I don't go to movies anymore. Hollywood doesn't represent me, and every dollar I give them through my movie tickets is a dollar they use to preach a lifestyle and a political agenda that I think works against the American people. So I do not go to movies anymore. I do not subscribe to my local newspaper anymore. And I am trying very hard as an individual not to put money in anyone's coffers if those people oppose what I consider to be the traditional American way of life.
Well,
and hopefully we can get.
I mean, so many of the entertainment products literally just, you know, are anti-American. Forget about R-rated or, you know, X-rated or anything else. I mean, you know, why should we patronize products like that? And I'm with you. I try to find out as much as I can about what I'm going to watch before I watch it and make a good decision. That's what it takes.
Well, listen, Joseph, I basically kept you on twice the amount of time that you promised me. And it wasn't my intention, but I just had such a good time talking with you. I wish you the best of luck with the Tea Party Manifesto. When this airs, we're going to have a link on the BlogNet or the Blog Talk Radio page that will allow people to click a button and immediately purchase this book as well as others that you've written. The name of the website, of course, is WorldNet Daily. And if you're interested in attending the Taking America Back conference from September 16th through the 18th, please go to TakingAmericaBack2010.com. Joseph, thanks once again for being with us. I wish you the best of luck in all you do.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Hopefully we can have you on again sometime.
I'd enjoy that. God bless.
Very good. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.